Previously broadcast program.
I don't believe in God, and I don't believe that there's a divine purpose or anything like that. So I believe we're animals that have become particularly intelligent animals, and we're capable of asking questions about our future, which apparently most other animals aren't able to do. We can imagine different futures. We can sort of think it could be like this or it could be like that, and what would it be like if it was like this other thing. And really the progress of human thought really is not the process of answering why we're here, but the process of saying, what could we do now we're here? So it's a question of, it's a creative question actually. It's saying, what do you think you can make of this situation you're in? Here you are, you're alive, you have some kind of power as a human, whatever that power is. It might be a very small amount of power, it might be a lot of power, but you can make things happen differently. Or you can make things happen the same over and over again. And so I think this is what makes us inherently political creatures, because we are aware of having choices. Politics is about choices, isn't it? It's about moral and ethical choices and trying to reimagine the world in some other way. And that's really a question of saying, where does the power lie? Who has the power? Why do they have it? What do they do with it? Could it be used differently? Could I have some? What will I do if I do? So there are a lot of interesting questions, but none of them are quite that question. Why are we here? I don't think that's answerable, essentially. So the rules change when it becomes obvious that the old rules don't work anymore. And this is that moment that I always think is very interesting, and I think we're at one of those moments now. The Russian writer Sergei Yerchak says this thing in one of his books that revolutions happen in two phases. The first phase is when everybody realizes that something is wrong. It's not working anymore. But the second phase, and the really important part, is when everybody realizes that everybody else also realizes that. So this is the big moment when you suddenly think, hey, we're not the minority, we're the majority. And most of us don't want this system. Most of us are unhappy with it. So when that happens, I think the thing starts to tip the other way. It's the tipping point, you know. And, I mean, I'm seeing this happening now in the discussion about Israel and Palestine, where suddenly a lot of people who used to say, oh, it's just too complicated for me, I don't understand it, I don't want to get involved. And, of course, that inaction is very much encouraged by the people who want the situation to stay as it is. But I think more and more people are saying, hold on, this just isn't right. This is not a difficult question. This is a simple question. There might be lots of complexity within it, but the basic issue is pretty simple. Something is badly wrong here. It it was actually quite a long time ago that I started to think about this, because as it happens, I was born on a very particular day, which is the 15th of May, 1948, which, as everybody knows, is the, for Palestinians, the Nakba, the catastrophe, when they were kicked off their land, and for Israelis, the beginning of the Israeli state. So I didn't actually know about the Palestinian side of the story. I always felt this sort of relationship to Israel because it was exactly the same age as me, to the day. And I was a big supporter of Israel in its early days. I can remember in the 60s and 70s being so impressed by many aspects of Israel. And I still am impressed by quite a few aspects of Israel. But the kibbutz movement very much chimed with my feelings about, you know, it's one of these, another one of these wonderful human experiments that I started out talking about. And it was a great experiment. And it was only in my, probably in my late 20s, that I started to realize there was this other story, which is the story of the Palestinians, the people, the other people who lived in that country. So I was paying attention to that from probably the mid-80s onwards, I guess, something like that. I was starting to become increasingly aware. However, at that time, it was still quite a different situation from now. For a start, most of the Israelis and most of the Palestinians had grown up together. Even though there was a transfer of land going on and a takeover of power going on, there were still credible courts in Israel that were not prejudiced inherently against the Palestinians. There were still quite a few mixed communities where Palestinians and Israelis lived together. So there was still some sort of sense of the possibility of a dialogue between them. I want both peoples to succeed and live happily. And I think it is not possible for either of them to do that in the present situation. I mean, we always think how bad the situation is for the Palestinians, and it clearly is, but it's bad for the Israelis as well. They are not becoming better people going through this process. They're becoming ruthless. They're becoming callous. They're losing any sense of empathy for the other people that they live with. So it is not good to be either the oppressor or the oppressed. They're both bad situations to be in. I mean, you can say, well, it's better for the Israelis because at least they chose it. But actually, people don't make those big choices in their life. You find yourself in a situation and generally you do what everybody else is doing. So, you know, I feel sorry for people growing up in Israel now as Israelis, carrying this, first of all, this story of their own victimhood, which is then used to justify making somebody else a victim. I mean, we all know about Jewish victimhood, and it's undeniable. You know, there's no doubt that some of the most awful crimes of history have been committed against Jews. And I can really, really, really understand why, given that history, you might feel paranoid. You might feel we've got to really watch out because this could happen again. However, the strategy that has evolved now, this very right-wing strategy of saying we'll just get rid of anyone who's potentially an enemy, that is not a good idea. That does not strengthen you. That makes you coarser. It makes you more violent, more vicious, and it doesn't really give you a very good life. It's like somebody who's permanently angry. As I say, you know, I, because of my date of birth, this funny coincidence, I've empathized with both sides of this. I sort of see myself following this through my life year by year and watching what's going on there and seeing peacemakers consistently being marginalized. You know, people like Marwan Barghouti, a very good man. Yitzhak Rabin, I think he was a very good man. Both of them, of course, in some senses, trapped in their circumstances. So there's not as much freedom of movement in those situations as you think. But given the freedom of movement that each of those people had, I think they were both honorable, good people. Well, Rabin was shot by a Jewish man, and Marwan Barghouti has been in prison for many years because he is probably the natural leader of the Palestinians. So that's the man they don't want out on the streets. And there have been many other people, you know. Issa Amro is another non-violent person who tried to do something good. But the something good that he wants to do isn't wanted. And this kind of reflexive thing that the right wing in Israel always does, of as soon as somebody says something that threatens their project, they say, oh, they're anti-Semitic. Of course they are. Well, that's just looking less and less credible now. And I think this is another tipping point thing. You know, once more and more people go onto that side of the scale and say, well, it smells like apartheid, it tastes like apartheid, it looks like apartheid, I think it is, then the thing starts to tip in that direction. I mean, I think there have been two factors working with artists, I think. First of all, the thing I said earlier, that the story has always been presented as very complicated. Oh, the history of the situation, you couldn't possibly understand it. It's so involved. Well, every situation is involved, actually. If you've ever tried looking into any situation, like how did that car crash happen, it's not simple. There's always so much going on. But we still make judgments all the time. We have to make judgments because you can't just sit there saying, well, it's too complicated, I can't do anything. Sometimes you have to do something. You have to get into a car again and drive, even if you didn't really figure out how that last crash happened. We're constantly making assessments of situations and saying, no, this crosses the line. And of course, it's possible for other people to say, oh, no, but you don't understand. It's really much more complicated than that. But we can't just stop doing things because we don't understand them. It's in the nature of humans. We're always doing things we don't understand. And we have to be able to make assessments and judgments about them as they unfold. And I think in this case, the case of Israel, it's getting more and more easy to make a judgment about whether this policy and this philosophy of one nation state will work. It obviously isn't working. You know, we've got a place that's falling apart for at least half of the inhabitants. And I think, as I said earlier, for all of them. There is never one spirit of the times. There's always lots of them. And they're always sort of fighting with each other and supporting each other. There's lots of spirits in any time. So I don't know what the German would be for that sort of multi-zeitgeist idea. But I think when we listen to music, when you listen to a piece of music, you don't only hear that piece of music. You hear that piece of music in relation to your whole history of listening to music. So what you notice is a difference. You think, ooh, that's so jagged. It's so exciting, that jaggedness. So jagged, or let's say rough or fierce, is a quality that you respond to. And you respond to it not in absolute terms, but in by how much it's different from what you've heard before. And then another quality might be very smooth. Another quality might be really fast. Another quality might be super funky. Another quality might be really gentle. You know, these are all things, but they're all in relation to other things you've heard. So just like I don't believe there's an answer to the first question you asked me, I think in a sense there isn't an intrinsic quality in music. Now, I realized this when I lived in Bangkok, and I had been going around with this sort of, I suppose, slightly hippie-ish idea that music was all good, you know. It was all, you know, if we paid attention, we could appreciate all of it, and it was all somehow an expression of the eternal human spirit, if we could only understand it. Then I went to the Chinese opera in Bangkok. The most baffling musical experience of my life. So baffling that I went back two more times because I just thought, what are they seeing? What are they hearing? You know, there'd be points when everyone burst into applause, but nothing had happened. You know, there's two people standing still on the stage, like, and suddenly everyone goes, and I thought, I didn't get that at all. And so then I abandoned that idea that music is something intrinsic. And I realized that music is relational. That's the word to use. You listen to music in relation to your history of listening. So every new song you hear, every new piece of music you hear, is like the sort of latest sentence in a long conversation you've been having. And that sentence might just be a repeat of another sentence that you've heard before, or it might be something you've never heard before. And suddenly that has a lot of meaning. And often what meaning amounts to is saying a sentence that seems particularly appropriate to this moment. Jagged. Yeah, that's right. The world has become jagged. And I identify this now because of this music. Suddenly I feel that. This is the world as I see it as well. And when a lot of people like something, it's in a way saying, we agree about this world. We are in this world. It's a fake world, you know, it's music. It's not real life. You can walk out and it stops. You can switch the record off. But while we're listening to it, we are sharing a vision of a world together. And we're sharing it and we're learning about it and we're understanding it and we're having feelings about it. And we can share those, we can talk about those feelings. But just by having them, we unite as a group of people. And that, I mean, that's a very short way of trying to tell you what I think music is about.
Black Rose Books invites you to our book launch event.
Confronting Canada's Past and Europe's Forgotten Revolutions.
Happening on Sunday, May 22nd, featuring the authors and editors of
Stand on Guard for Whom?
The Fire That Time.
Insatiable Hunger.
The Forgotten Revolution.
And Black Ukraine Yesterday and Today.
Join us on live stream or in person at 2 p.m.
at the Cité des Hospitalières, 251 Pine West. Corner Park.
Free tickets are available at blackroselaunch.eventbrite.ca or visit blackrosebooks.com for more information.
This event is co-presented with the Cité des Hospitaliers en Transition and CKUT-FM.
NTSS.
Thank you.
Lo de lejos y de cerca. Anda para allá y cuenta otro, el que a ti te guste. Cuenta un cuento lindo.
A ver, me meto porque me dice que te va a volar. Y ahí había un muy grande aquí.
Thank you.
Lebanon, Vietnam, Iraq, Vietnam, Palestine, Vietnam. They wanna see us gone. So far from home, I can feel the bombs close to heart, like the death of a Vietnam. War made us feel like being free is wrong. Trying to be a man with a child's favorite song. Lullabies when a brother dies. No merit when a sister perish us, America. Drilling with loud toys, it's the cowboy. Bullet riddle the Middle East for little peace. Giving in to the inner cheek, over to the feast. Like a winner, you pride oil and doubt joy. The same resource you drain came from remains of deceased corpses, vain. All in plain view, like Daniel Day-Lewis. I knew it. You giving off that kill me buzz, there will be blood.
Oh, like Vietnam. If your family was raped, taken, beaten on, I bet you wouldn't or couldn't live and be as strong. Weak minds don't pray at all. They want to stay in battle and play the cattle, debate about them. I want to change the channel, but my honor claim to babble. Exonerate the beings wrong. What is Vietnam? The concept of a long mess. And claiming that our Congress is aware of the fact. The conflict over barren land. By the street of blame, it's a bomb. It's the orphans. Bodies with wings, orphans. Sharp sticks and jaws. Sin and all sin. You want to pull a Mike Jack blood on the dance floor, him. You got more love for a man's dog. Damn, dog.
Russ.
I know I'm fine.
Russ.
But the money makes me handsome.
The Journey is Everything Tour.
If I seduce you, babe.
Saturday, May 28th, Place Bell.
Got the best song. Yeah, yeah.
Russ.
Got me going psycho.
With special guests, Boogies and Caitlin. Tickets on sale now at evenko.ca. Russ, The Journey is Everything Tour.
And the fans are asking for it. They're loving it.
What they want, what they want, what they want.
This program is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
Yo, 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 yo.